Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. This one's going to be interesting. Not only has he have written many books, he is a true expert in his field. He's been around the block. He's easy to find on Google. And if you are looking for somebody who knows his stuff in this field, he has a Wikipedia page. So that means he has some relevance in the marketplace. The book that we're talking about, I guess we're going to talk about a few books, but the most recent one that just came out a couple months ago is called When Science Meets Power. And there's a book that I really wanted to ask him about, and that's called Social Innovation, How Societies Find the Power to Change. Jeff Mulligan is here. Thanks so much for being here, man.
Hi, Mike. Great to be with you.
Well, let's start off with maybe the genesis of the book that I wanted to have you on the podcast for, and that's Social Innovation. We're going to bounce around because you have so many books, but what made you want to write that book?
So I've got a background which is a little bit mixed. So I've got a PhD in technology, telecoms, which I did many at MIT. So I got very into the technology space. Then I've worked in governments and in civil society, and I've run investment funds and startups and so on. And the thing which I became more and more obsessed with was that, in a way, in the 20th century, we got pretty good at knowing how you got economies to grow, how to, you know, raise GDP, how to make some people incredibly rich.
Yep.
But actually, often that came alongside real failures to solve social problems, inequality, poverty, drug addiction, mental health, you name it. And so my interest for many years has really been, how do we galvanize, harness some similar kind of creativity, innovation, entrepreneurial energy, but to actually solve problems which may matter more than a better way of ordering a pizza or a better way of selling real estate or stuff like that? This seems to me just kind of blindingly obvious. That's what our world needs, and certainly countries like the US need it. And yet our institutions for doing that are much weaker. We have many fewer funds to do it, much less training, much less method. And I think we're still pretty bad at it by comparison with how good we are maybe at innovating new pharmaceuticals or new, you know, electric vehicles or new kinds of software. So that's the genesis. And what the book tries to do is set out how to think about it. Lots of examples from history and from around the world, and then some guides to how collectively you might do this a little bit better. That's basically what it's about.
Beautiful. And so it sounds like you're a capitalist with a heart. Is that what you're saying? More so than anything?
Well, I've been in some roles a pure capitalist. I say I've run venture investment funds, and I used to run a big, you know, half billion plus of funds. So I've been involved in that. This is, in a way, is using some of the same skills any entrepreneur does to understand, you know, a need, to understand a niche, a product or a service, and then put it into to the world. But often where there isn't really a functioning market, there may not be anyone ready to pay for solving homelessness or drug addiction or poverty. And that's why you have to think much more imaginatively about solutions in this kind of space.
Yeah, and you bring up a very good point about mental health. I just saw a stat, and I can pull it up here in a little bit, but depression is skyrocketing, right? We have all this opportunity, and I just saw the median wage in the United States went from, I think, 1951. I was looking at some stats on Google, but right around $3,000. Now we're up to about $63,000. So the money skyrocketing, right? The opportunities there. Supposedly the education is way better. Yet, and this comes from a Gallup poll that's featured in ABC News, and I believe it's May of 2023. Women's rates of depression during their lifetimes climbed from 26.2% in 2017 to 36.7% in 2023. Rates of those with current depression increased from 17.6 to 23.8 over the same period. By comparison, men with depression during their lifetime saw a similar increase from 17.7 in 2017 to 20.4 in 2023. So, when you talk about social change, we have all of these new bells and whistles, yet the mental health is declining. Individuals are less happy. What is going on, and how do we fix that?
Yeah, so this has been kind of an obsession of mine for quite a few years. When I was in government, I tried to look at, you know, what could government do? How do you measure happiness? And in Britain, we started through the government measuring it about 12, 13 years ago. And then what can you do? And a little social innovation, which might be of interest to people seeing this, is Action for Happiness, which I founded with a couple of partners as a little sort of charity about 14 years ago. Now the Dalai Lama is our patron. And what we try and do is bring together the science of happiness. What do we actually know about what you can do in your own life, but also in a workplace or in a school or in a neighborhood? And it turns out there's quite a lot you can do. As you say, we've got mountains of evidence now that something is going wrong in our societies. It's quite complicated, particularly teenagers. The more they use social media, the unhappier they seem to be. But also many people facing midlife crises of all kinds, crises of loneliness, amazing numbers of people of all ages feeling, you know, desperately lonely. And I think a lot of it, well, there's a lot of aspects to it. One is about this weird paradox of social connection. The period when the internet became part of all our lives appears to be the time when, in countries like the US, the numbers of people who said they could count on others to help them out in a crisis sharply fell. Basically, it went up from about, I think, 8 or 9% to about 25%, said there was no one they could turn to help them in a crisis, even though their Facebook friends and so on might have been multiplying. There was something deeply problematic going on the level of social connections. And this matters because one of the ways you make yourself happy is not just by getting a big car and so on, but it's actually doing stuff with other people or helping other people or giving other people. Caring for other people is one of the best ways to be happy. So if you're very isolated and cut off and fearful of the world, you get into a kind of downward spiral. You may take more and more, you know, pills to help you out, but they often don't really work. So the stuff we've been doing with Action for Happiness and others is really trying to get people back to the basics of human relationships, appreciate nature, learn to look after yourself and your fitness and your diet and all sorts of stuff like that. And then there's a kind of bigger task, which I've been working on the last year or so, which is what can you do at the level of a city or a nation to really improve the well-being of not just maybe the 1% or 2% of people who suffer from really severe schizophrenia, depression, and so on, but maybe it's 10, 20, as you say, 30, maybe 30 plus percent in their lifetime, people struggling with anxiety and depression. What can you do to help them? Just give that a little bit of support. It could be online support. It could be community centers. It could be coaches and therapists to try and turn back this tide of unhappiness, which is crazy. We live in some ways the best time ever in human history. Mm-hmm. It's a tragedy that we've so failed to fix this problem, even though physical health, in many ways, we have the most amazing hospitals and med tech stuff to fix your heart or fix your cancer or, you know, a limb. But we're much, much worse when it comes to, yeah, fixing what's in there.
Do you believe that because of technology is advancing so fast, it's making individuals' lives easier, and without struggle there's actually no joy, and so therefore if you remove pain, adversity, and struggle from an individual, you actually rob that individual's soul of pleasure from accomplishing a goal? Do you think that has anything to do with it?
There's a little bit, and I mean, I actually quite like the way technology makes life easier. I much don't want to go back to a world before we had Google Maps to help me across.
Oh, good point. City. Terrible, yes.
But you're right. We as humans, we grow, we thrive through kind of narrative arcs, which often involve some setback, some challenge, and then you overcome them and you end up bigger. There's a, I don't know if you know the book by Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Oh, come on. You're speaking our language. Joseph Campbell, The Hero's Journey, of course.
Exactly. The Hero's Journey, the basis of Star Wars. I just a few weeks ago, in fact, just last week, published a thing on storytelling, looking at all these different frameworks for universal stories. And there are lots of them. But they nearly all have that kind of pattern where you have to go down before you go up. You have to face a problem, a setback. And it's in the process of overcoming some kind of adversity that you become bigger and actually become happier. So I think if we all live completely safe, completely sanitized lives where maybe, you know, robots cooked all our meals and everything for us, we'd be pretty miserable in that kind of world. We're not designed for that. We're designed to be in environments which are a little bit challenging.
Yeah, I think
it's good for kids too. I think it's really important if anyone who has children that you don't overprotect them from the world. Again, they learn, they grow through, you know, cuts and grazes and falling off bikes and so on. That's how we become fully human.
Yeah, I think identity is absolutely a must to understand who you are, what you want, where you're going, and what you're capable of. And I think individuals are being robbed of understanding that it's important to fall in love with you, who you are, right? And this probably does tie into your book to some degree, but the medical world, have you come across any data, any science that's actually proving that by giving an individual any type of pharmaceuticals or anything at a very young age, it actually changes the makeup of the brain, the chemistry, and therefore they develop in a negative manner, and therefore they are reliant. They're not totally dependent, or they're not totally independent. They're actually becoming dependent on the pharmaceutical world, thus changing their state of mind, increasing depression levels, and maybe their work ethic. Anything you've come across in there?
I don't know about evidence on that, but there's obviously a huge proportion of teenagers now being medicated with all sorts of antidepressants. And I'd be surprised if in 10 or 20 years' time, we didn't see some patterns. Neuroscience, in my understanding, isn't quite sophisticated enough really to analyze what's going on inside your brain. They use, you know, fMRI and these other tools, which are pretty crude. I mean, neuroscience is a much less sophisticated science than I think most people assume. It's very good at sort of hyping itself. But I mean, a lot of therapies, no one really knows how they work. And this is certainly true of most pills given to people. Psychology is based on dealing with symptoms and simply doesn't have causal models about why they might work, except at the crudest level, let's say on, you know, serotonin and so on. I'm not a neuroscientist, but I know many neuroscientists who in private will admit to all of this. So I think you're probably right in your expectation. There will be some, obviously, dependence, some structural change to brains if they have been taking a lot of antidepressants from, I don't know, 13 onwards. But I'd be surprised if we really knew that yet. It's the same with social media. You know, we've had a 15 years or whatever of the smartphone. It's clear this correlates with all sorts of patterns of anxiety and depression and social unease, but we still don't really know exactly what the causal mechanisms are. That's why I love science, because science is a constant process of trying to work things out, trying to discover. And the more you know, the more you often realize you don't know.
True. Yep. And so is there any clean takeaway from that book on, you know, how societies can change? And I only have maybe two or three ideas that I think will work. And so if there's anything that you were able to correlate with maybe the change from 1950 till now, is technology going up, spirituality and religion going down. So in my opinion, I look at maybe one way to change society is maybe have more of a belief or have more of a push for spirituality. I would think that would be something. And then also adopting technology to use rather than to be used by. And the way I kind of frame it is think like an entrepreneur. If you do that, you can find opportunities. You can start to think for yourself. You're not going to believe the media and everybody all the time. You're going to do your own research, but you're also going to realize that personal transformation is required for you to add value to the world. And so if you think like an entrepreneur and you start to have more faith in God, I believe a lot of this can be fixed. What say you?
Well, going back to your first question, what have we really learned about how societies find the power to change? Here, I use an analogy with science. If you go back to the 19th century in America or Britain or anywhere else, what was the life of a scientist? They were basically working a little shed in their back garden, fiddling around with chemicals and doing things in a fairly, you know, random way. And then in the 20th century, we learned that if you really want science to motor, you've got to organize it. So companies created huge labs like DuPont or IBM. Governments created enormous programs in the US. Vannevar Bush was the great pioneer of this and what led to things like NASA and DARPA and so on. And enormous amounts of public money going into the discovery of new ideas. I don't know if you've ever seen the photographs of Bell Labs, which was probably the most innovative place on the planet, where, you know, the semiconductor, fiber optics, all these things came out of it. But it's an enormous, looks like a sort of a bureaucratic corridors with men in, mainly men in white coats in it. And in a way, the key lesson was, if you want systematic innovation, and the science world has given that to an extraordinary degree, you've got to organize it, you've got to fund it, you've got to create roles. Now, when it comes to social innovation, that is to say innovation to maybe tackle loneliness or mental health or poverty or failure at school, we don't do any of that. We rely on slightly random individuals coming up with a good idea. There aren't proper funds, minuscule by comparison with hardware innovation. There's nothing remotely like a Bell Labs, you know, trying out all sorts of things with brilliant scientists. The public funds are essentially zero in this space. So even though there are lots of social entrepreneurs, and in the past I've helped set up schools for social entrepreneurs, the odds are massively against them. And I think you're right, we need to cultivate that entrepreneurial energy, but we'd be misreading what happened in science and technology if we thought that's all that had driven, you know, Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley would not exist without massive public spending, mainly through the Department of Defense, on all sorts of programs, huge universities like Stanford and so on. Is that combined with the individual entrepreneurship then gets you momentum. And in the social side, we're missing almost all the parts of that equation, which is why I see a widening gap between, as it were, you know, economic success and social success. I think spirituality is undoubtedly part of that. It's a great motive for people who want to care, who want to love, who want to re-engage with the natural world and ecology. But here there's a really important point. I was very lucky at 17. I spent time in a Buddhist monastery in Sri Lanka and was very immersed in that tradition. And a key, what a lot of Buddhists say, is that the West sometimes took about half the spiritual tradition, which was just about what you do for yourself, your own personal practice, and forgot the other side of it, which was all about compassion and relating better to other people, which is deep in the Buddha's teachings. And yet we got this sort of slightly commoditized, consumerist version came to the West, where spirituality was just something you did on your own. Maybe you did it through an app or you read books or whatever. And people find, I think quite unsatisfying, because again, that's not really what we're like as human beings. We depend on others. And in Buddhism, the monastery was the main institution, which was not being a lone hermit, it's being with others. So part of our social renewal has to be being a little bit suspicious of over-individualistic solutions to anything. And it also applies to entrepreneurs. You know, every successful entrepreneur is good at creating teams, is good at working with others. They might be a bit maddening and impossible and so on, but if they're only individualistic, they're not going to find anyone who wants to work with them, who wants to give up their life. So again, I think we often have slightly misleading frames which over-glorify the pure lone individual solving everything. Whereas if you actually always read the histories of the really successful entrepreneurs, you discover there's a whole army of other people around them who often get a bit ignored in the stories, but who were crucial to helping them, you know, solve the complex problems of marketing and finance and product development and relations with the investors and so on. So I always look at the networks in a way, the social side of things, not just treating individuals as if they're standalone atoms without, you know, without any context. That's not how the world works. It's not how people usually succeed.
What made you fall in love with this hero's journey, this entrepreneurial pathway, or the ability to maybe affect change, the society around you, the community around you? What made you take this road? And was it a parent? Was it an experience? Was it a book? Because I bring up Rich Dad Poor Dad pretty frequently on this podcast, because it's the one that made me understand what an entrepreneur really was, and I never looked back. So any defining moments that stand out in your life?
Well, I was quite an angry teenager, so that's probably what started me.
We're all rebels. Us entrepreneurs were rebels at heart, am I right?
And I was angry. The society around me just seemed pretty wrong, pretty unfair, pretty mean.
In London?
I was brought up in London at a time, well, then it was under Margaret Thatcher. There was a lot of social division, a lot of a widening gap between the rich and the poor. And it didn't look to me like the people who were doing best deserved to. They were often, you know, they're often the worst, not the best people. So I guess that then spurred me into this interest in social change. And I guess I realized, I learned, you know, how much of the world around us, it looks kind of solid, but actually once you start doing things, you realize the world is much more fluid, much more plastic than it seems. It's been created by people, and then we treat it as if it's a kind of part of the landscape. Whereas pretty much, you know, all the organizations around us, somebody at one point invented, and they didn't exist before, and it looked a bit crazy. I had one really good mentor, who was a guy called Michael Young, who was a great American professor, once called him the most successful social entrepreneur in the world, because he created about 100 new organizations, and in his 80s started creating private companies and selling them to venture capital, which is quite a weird thing to do in your 80s. But he was really good at just inventing new stuff, but making it real as well. And there were some of his sayings which really affected me. Like, he always said, take no as a question, not an answer. Because every single idea he'd ever had, the first reaction he got from people was, no, it won't work. We won't give you money, or we're already doing it. You know, and some of them say all of those at the same time. And he said, use it as an energizing force. You know, use it as a question. How can I next time, you know, persuade them? Don't be disheartened. So no as a question on answers, quite a useful idea. And he was always willing just to take risks, just to start by doing things. Don't try and have an incredibly detailed plan on paper. Right. Often the best way to do something is just go for it. Start at small scale, learn by doing iteratively. So what's become normal in software, he was doing back in the 1950s and 60s, and he had a whole body of sort of theory and processes, but they were very opposite to the way, I guess, governments usually work or universities. And I love that ethos that you'll learn best by diving in and doing stuff, not by sitting in an ivory tower or sort of writing 500-page business plans, which don't survive their first encounter with reality.
Right. Yeah. How many professors are out there teaching entrepreneurship who've never started a business? It just blows my mind.
Yeah. Well, it's very nerve-wracking starting organization. I've just started another one about a month ago, actually. So I love startups, but it's constantly anxious, because especially if it's an imaginative idea, you will struggle to get support. You will struggle to get money, and you'll always be a little bit worried. You'll be humiliated, or it'll be a complete yeah. failure. Personally, I find that quite exciting. And then I've been on the other side running, say, startup accelerators and funds, where we have streams of people pitching to us. So I got quite good at, I guess, at coaching people on how to do pitches and what would work with people like me. But I admire people who are willing to jump off the cliff and just try something and not just moan about it or not tell someone else to fix a problem. You know, if you see a problem, be the solution. Don't wait for someone else to do it.
Yeah, I think that's the that's the message I like to share, is that the individuals who are the happiest are the ones who are not waiting for the world to be fixed for them to move forward. It's, hey, let me focus on myself. Let me clean my room. Let me fix what's broken in my house, in my life first, and then let me focus on changing the world, right? So individuals out there are waiting for the world to get perfect for them to actually maybe be content with everything. That's impossible, right? You would much rather that everything around you to be your fault, because then you can have some type of control in fixing it. And I think us entrepreneurs, we have this self-reliance, this accountability. Hey, I can't worry about all this other stuff until I worry about what's right here in front of me. And I think that is awesome for anybody to notice, that entrepreneurs, we're just going to get out there. We're going to jump off that cliff. We're going to build the airplane on the way down. We'll figure it out, because a plan with 100% commitment, even if it's a shitty plan, there's a much better likelihood of it coming true rather than the perfect plan with 50% of the way commitment, right? It's all about in the action and the requirement of giving it your all every step of the way. And you will never know what's around the corner for every adventure. So just go, get started, fix yourself. It's a personal journey, transformation journey, disguised as a business journey. As long as you stay at it, you're going to get better, more refined, and your value is going to be added to the marketplace. And people like you will notice it. So you bring up a very good point there. People go in to pitch their ideas, worrying about their business plans. What are some tips that you recommend to our listeners, our viewers, that you would say to them on how to do the perfect pitch or how to even get started with a business?
Yeah. Well, can I just go back one step to what you said earlier? Because that, and then I will come on to pitching. Yeah. So what you described about entrepreneurs is actually also true of activists. It's true of leadership more generally. And one of the other organizations I helped set up is a leadership development program called Uprising for 18 to 24-year-olds. We teach them how to be leaders. And what's really interesting is they often start off thinking they've got no power. You know, you're an 18-year-old, maybe you're a refugee from Somalia or whatever, you're in this big world, you see all these systems and you feel powerless. And we always try and get them to think about what little bit of power you do have. And then they have to run real campaigns. It's a year-long program where they have to do stuff in the real world where they live. They get coaches and support to do that. But I think they learn far more in that year of trying to change the world and learning by changing it than they would in a university reading books. I'm a professor at a university, so I shouldn't say this, but it's definitely true. And then we've increasingly shifted the course so the self-knowledge grows as well as the knowledge of the outside world, because there's a weird phenomenon with these leaders, and it's the same with entrepreneurs. You need a mixture, I would say, of arrogance and humility. It is quite arrogant to believe that you will have an amazing product, you will change the world, you'll fix things. And if you've got none of that arrogance, you won't be much good. But if you've only got arrogance, you don't listen. You don't get the messages. You don't, you
know. That was me. Whenever I was 18, I had all the answers and I didn't know shit, right?
Exactly. So you've got to cultivate always this weird contradictory balance of humility and arrogance, and always make sure they're not getting a little too, you're not so humble, you don't try and do anything, but you're not so arrogant, you just become an idiot or a moron. And we see lots of leaders who do that. Now, that maybe slightly relates to the perfect pitch. I'm not sure there is a perfect pitch. But in a way, that's also what you're often looking to see in the entrepreneur, the pitcher, that they've got the inner strength to get through the setbacks. There's bound to be setbacks and things going wrong. So a little bit of arrogance. But you don't want some pompous self-important idiot who you can tell won't be able to motivate other people, won't learn from those around them, won't get the right messages. And usually, I mean, the main stuff I always used to see was just not enough focus, actually, not a clear enough proposition, and cash. I mean, the really boring stuff, I mean, you'll know all of this, where so many projects go wrong is just failure to think through rigorously cash management. Yes. And that's what kills the great majority of startups. They burn through the cash. They don't think about it hard enough. It's great to have a fantastic idea, but you've also got to keep some cash in the bank. Otherwise, you disappear. But so simplicity, clarity of diagnosis, prescription, why you, and then the sequences, even though if you're on the panel, you know that much of that will change in reality. But you do want the sense they've thought those bits through, and then that they've got this inner character which will help them learn really fast when the world pushes back on their idea, as it's bound to do.
Hmm. Yeah, it wasn't until my fifth startup that I actually made money, which does kind of lend to the fact that you just really need to get through these first few failures without losing your soul, right? So there are people out there who maybe go in to do that pitch for the first time or start a business and they fail. I've known a lot of people throughout my journey. It's wild how they fail. One time they're done, and then they hate capitalism, they hate entrepreneurship, you know, and they're all about, hey, the government needs to take care of me. It's pretty crazy. And so you probably see the same thing. What makes it for those people who actually get to the finish line or get to that successful business after failure, after failure, after failure? Is there just something inside of them that just won't die? Do they have something to prove? Is there a chip on their shoulder? Any trend that you've noticed?
Well, one other thing which we try and teach entrepreneurs, and it's probably the most important skill any human can have in life, and it's very difficult, is how to ask for help. In a way, many people are brought up to feel they have to be self-sufficient. They have to have the answer to everything. But the thing I often observe about successful people in many fields is they will ask for help from everyone. And they'll be completely unembarrassed about asking for, might be for advice or a contact. Or
Richard Branson's famous for saying what you just said, by the way. Very famous. Yeah. He used to help. He has to ask for help because he couldn't read. He had dyslexia.
Yeah. And I think it's a really sort of universal thing. And it's quite hard for very smart people or people who've been a bit successful to recognize just how incredibly important it is to ask for help. And then if you do fail, as you're bound to fail, or you're likely to fail with your first two or three things, it is that cultivating the learning. The other thing my mentor I mentioned earlier used to say is always seek out your severest critics. Be hungry for that kind of quite demanding, challenging feedback. Again, it may be psychologically a bit difficult. You think you've got an amazing idea, you know, you're going to be the next TikTok or whatever. You might not like someone tearing it apart. And they might be wrong as they tear it apart, but it's very rare for that process not to be useful for you, to somehow help you sharpen up your thinking. So it's, I mean, this applies again in many walks of life. It's useful to try and find your smartest critic and really listen to them. Not obviously, you'll be quite careful that they don't completely destroy your confidence, but to take out from them an insight into how you can be most successful. That's a humility point again. You've got to be humble enough to feed off criticism. And again, that's asking for help, but in a very particular way. So, I don't think there is a sort of gene. I don't think there is. I mean, there's been vast amounts of research on entrepreneurs and leadership. Indeed, once when I was in the British government, we did this huge meta study on leadership and entrepreneurship to see if there were common patterns. We looked at tens of thousands of research studies. They all, almost all their findings, you could find other ones which had exactly contradictory findings, with only one exception. There was one common feature. I don't know if you can guess what that is.
I would just say stick-to-itiveness, I guess, is probably the
exactly.
way. That's it.
The only is persistence, basically. Resilience is the only. Everything else, you know, you could have wildly authoritarian ones or collaborative
grit.
Ones. Or
just grit, creative. Right? You can't teach that. You have it or you don't. Am I right?
Exactly. Well, no, I think you can. You can learn it a little bit. I don't think it's genetic. I think you can be. You can learn techniques of resilience and life experiences which forge it. But if you don't have it, you probably won't do very well.
Got it. Now you teach individuals from 18 to 24, I believe, was the age group to become leaders.
This is a project I set up, or it's an organization I co-founded with someone else. And it's taught thousands of people. It's all over the UK and all the big cities. But that was just one example, because we had to think through exactly the issues you were talking about. Mainly for people to be kind of potential public leaders, though many became entrepreneurs. We found they're very similar issues, actually. And often people concluded they could achieve more impact in the world starting a business than they could by becoming a politician or, whatever else.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Who do you think is affecting change more? Do you think it's Elon Musk or do you think it's the president? And it is by far Elon Musk. He's the one that's driving this, I believe. So people follow him. They look up to him. I think they are inspired by him more so than the president. So I think of entrepreneurship as the way to change. Do you agree?
I think it's a way to change. I don't buy that as a generalization in the world. I don't think if you look at the last 100 years, yes, some of the entrepreneurs had big impact, but actually so did governments. In the pandemic, you know, what really helped the world cope with the biggest ever global crisis? It was actually governments. They very quickly helped develop a vaccine. They very quickly provided money to every family. They very quickly, you know, locked down cities and so on. There was no entrepreneur able to do that. So I would push back on that. I think entrepreneurs do achieve a great deal, but the idea they're the only source of change, I think, is completely wrong. I'm sorry.
Got it. Okay. You're allowed to disagree. All right. I just look at politicians as very much, are you familiar with the movie, The Lord of the Rings?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you give them the ring, right? They're never giving it up, right? Therefore, they always are given, taking a little bit more, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think that's the phrase. So I just think that when you start to give individuals who might be able to get votes, it's very difficult for them to give up power. And so I just look at entrepreneurs as, you know, the free market decides. You know, the government behind the scenes, that's what decides more so than anything. So I just look at that, and that's why I have sort of a pushback on it. But do you believe in that? You know, do you think that once you give the government too much power, it's only inevitable until they actually do something very harmful?
Well, the whole point of democracy is that we kick the leaders out if we don't want them anymore. Politicians don't like giving up power, but then neither do entrepreneurs. If you've started a huge business, you know, every business goes into a battle between the entrepreneur and their board and their investors trying to get rid of them. So I think you know, that's just a common pattern of human beings. I mean, I think democracy is a pretty good system because we kick them out before they become like Vladimir Putin, who just got, you know, elected to whatever it was 2 days ago. I think after 10 years, political leaders should all be gone.
Bingo. But, I'm with you on that. Term limits, right? That's all you need.
For CEOs. But do you think that for CEOs?
For CEOs? No.
I believe so.
All right. So individuals who start a company, it's their baby. It's their idea, right? So that's that. They become CEOs. But CEOs are based off of the performance, right? So if the company's doing really well, then like, for example, the NFL, Goodell, I don't like him. I'm not even a big football fan, but he's made the NFL tons of money. So he's a great CEO, right? But if you look at certain politicians who have been politicians for 50 years, it makes sense for you to be a corrupt individual simply because I'll do some back end deals and I'll buy my way into the next level, or I'll stick around. So politics and business to me are very different. Do you disagree on that?
They're certainly different. And I agree, if a CEO is really working well, you might as well keep them. Though usually they try and stay too long. I actually don't think, I mean, it's a kind of cliche that all politicians are corrupt. And probably if you did a poll in the UK or anywhere else, everyone would say, oh, they're all corrupt. I think that's almost completely untrue. I mean, a few are corrupt, but it's a sort of invention of social media world and slightly fantasy. It's in many countries, it's actually pretty hard to be corrupt as a politician. You're much more under scrutiny. Your accounts are seen, even quite small, you know, like in Scandinavia, if you use your credit card for one additional item of €100, $100, you know, you had to resign. So that in fact, the rules are much more stringent in much of the world. In other parts, the politicians like Putin, again, he's the richest man in Russia. He's massively corrupt. But it's a really dangerous generalization and really lazy, this claim, oh, they're all useless, they're all corrupt. And it's used by the corrupt ones because they try and spread this myth, because then it's easier for them to get away with their lies and their deceits. But it's really important to be smart and much more, you know, rigorous in questioning these sort of lazy assumptions. In the UK, for example, you know, most politicians earn far less than people in business. A tiny number are corrupt, but not many. I almost feel sorry for them because they work really hard, and usually they've given up much more, you know, lucrative alternative careers. And then the public says, oh, of course, they're all corrupt. So don't believe everything kind of the internet conventional wisdom says. It's sometimes true, but often it's completely wrong.
Well, I just look at maybe their bank account. So individuals exactly. who make their money in the private sector, then they get into politics. Hey, I trust you a lot more, right? But individuals who get into politics and go from nothing to multimillionaire, I mean,
that's pretty suspicious.
There you go. I'm with you on that. That's all I'm saying.
But in Europe, that's very rare. Very, you know, very rare.
Nancy Pelosi, her net worth is $290 million. She has not made more than $180,000 in her entire life per year. So that is just unbelievable. I can't believe people don't see it. So I'm with you. Maybe not all, but it's a great chance. If they're a career politician, they're in it for the money rather than the service. Am I right? You agree with that? Career politicians, not a good sign. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. I think they should do a mix of different things. I don't want lifetime politicians. I think the US completely destroyed its politics with the funding rules.
You mean the
Citizens United deal.
Yep.
Politics has to be kept insulated from money. If your politicians are basically be bought by the ultra rich, if they themselves become rich, then you've got a corrupted politics. I'd agree with that. And it's really sad as a foreigner to see how the US has allowed its political system to be really corrupted deeply by these changes to the law. In other countries like mine, luckily we have very strict rules on how much money can be given, how much money can be taken. As I say, it leaves the politicians a bit poor and miserable sometimes, but I'd much rather that than ones where they had a few hundred million in the bank account and where you know, a handful of billionaires can basically buy whoever they want. That's what you get in some poor countries. It's what happened in Russia. Putin's worth, what, $100 billion or something.
They say he's the richest man in the world, yeah.
Yeah, but democracies really have to stop this pollution, essentially. I think money can pollute politics just as politics can pollute business. I don't think politicians should be, you know, running big businesses, but I don't think big business should be running politics. It always ends in tears.
Oh, I'm with you. So we agree on that. And Jeff, we could talk for hours on this stuff, but guys, check out his newest book. It's called When Science Meets Power. I really wanted to get into one of his chapters. He talks about the master and the servant. And I just think that at all times we are either the master or the servant. So be aware of it. So I thought we can get into that. Maybe you can come back on again, because your books, I mean, it seems like you're putting one out every year or so. So you can come back on whenever the new one comes out. How about that?
That would be great. Oh. And I mean, and the last one last year was all about imagination, which might be of interest, because in a way it was, what are the methods you can really use to expand your imagination, to think beyond perhaps what the business models of this year are to what might be possible 5, 10, 20 years into the future. And I'm really keen on expanding our sense of the possible and not being just being trapped in the realities of the present.
Wow. AI, right? It's, I mean, scary for some. I think very exciting for many, right? So depends on how you use it. You don't want to be used by it, but oh my, the world is going to look different, I think, 10 years from now.
Absolutely.
So guys, check out his books. Is there a social media channel that you are posting to more so than any other, or a website do you want to promote?
X, I can be followed on X or LinkedIn. I'm fairly regularly stuff like the stuff on stories from last week. If you're interested in storytelling, that was on both of those platforms last week.
I'm going to go check it out right now. So it's easy to find you. Is it just Jeff Mulgan? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I mean, anything about the hero's journey, I'm in. So guys, look him up. He's easy to find. Like I said, Wikipedia page, many books on Amazon, and very knowledgeable. And I loved London when I was there in 2005. I was there for a couple of days and I absolutely loved it. So, you know, I have a sentiment to anybody from London. I'm like, all right, you guys treated me well while I was there. So it was an honor to have you on, sir. And I really appreciate your time and your knowledge on this topic.
Thank you, Mike. And everyone's welcome in London anytime.
All right. Remember, guys, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.